It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It's primary election day in Pennsylvania, featuring municipal and county contests from city council to county council to district attorney to the Pittsburgh School Board. Some longtime incumbents could face their stiffest challenges in many years. We're turning to our own newsroom this morning. Ariel Worthy covers city government, and Sarah Schneider is WESA's education reporter. Thanks to both of you for starting your day with the Confluence.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So let's start with city council, Ariel. Incumbents in the odd-numbered districts are seeking renomination today. They're all Democrats in a Democratic stronghold. So this is likely to be the main event as opposed to the general election in November. Only Corey O'Connor in District 5 is unopposed. District 1 could be a possible upset in the making. Incumbent Darlene Harris seeking a fourth four-year term. Who's her competition in District 1?
Well, she has competition in Bobby Wilson. This is, I believe, his fourth time running. This time around, he is endorsed by the mayor, which was a big shock to many people, and it was a big deal to him as well. And she's also facing Mark Brentley, who was also a school board member in the past, and he actually was on the school board with Darlene Harris.
And you said a shock, but Darlene Harris is no big supporter of Bill Peduto, as you reported on when you were profiling this race.
Yeah, but she will tell you, she says, she doesn't disagree with him to be difficult. She votes based on how she actually feels on things. If she does not feel legislation should be passed, she will vote no on it. And it's not to just be in opposition of the mayor. It's because she truly feels that it is something that should not pass.
Was there a standout issue in District 1, would you say?
Not really. There were a few things that the candidates said that they would like to see more of. Bobby Wilson spoke about complete streets, which made the roads more friendly to drivers, bikers, and pedestrians. He wanted to see more of that in District 1. Mark Brentley said that he wanted to see the growth that was happening in District 1 in Northview Heights, particularly like where there's public housing. He feels that some of those areas are really being left out. So he just said he wanted to just have the counselor kind of pay more attention to those neighborhoods.
You also covered closely District 9, where Reverend Ricky Burgess is also seeking a fourth term. What are the issues that you reported on in this particular race?
Many of the concerns were about gentrification in that district. One candidate in particular, Shirley Fuller, she said that she had been impacted by it directly. Her mother lived in a public housing complex that had been torn down a few years ago and was promised that she could come back after they were rebuilt. But her mother, as well as a lot of other residents, were not able to come back. So she's kind of worried that the same thing's going to happen in the future with a lot of the rebuilding that's happening in the district. And a lot of them are just kind of addressing that affordable housing issue in District 9.
Very briefly, your colleagues in the government and politics team covered races in Districts 3 and 7. What are we looking for there?
Well, you have Council President Bruce Krause in District 3, and he's up against Ken Wolfe, and he was a former aide to Krause.
Right.
And Chris Comanchik, he calls himself a moderate Democrat. So that's that race.
And District 7, Deb Gross is up for renomination.
Yes, and she is up against Deidre Kane.
Okay. Well, let's move on to our education reporter, Sarah Schneider. Bring her into the conversations. Sarah, even numbered districts that are up for election this year. So give us a sense of who's running.
Correct. So there are 9 candidates running for 4 seats. There's one incumbent, District 8, Kevin Carter, is running unopposed. And in the other 3 seats, you know, they're pretty competitive this year. We have a lot of candidates. In District 4, that's a very competitive, high-profile district this year. We have a race between Pam Harbin and Anna Batista. They both spent about $33,000 on this campaign.
That sounds like a lot for a school
board. That's quite
race.
A bit of money for school board. And they both have Pam Harbin has a long list of endorsements, both national, local, state. Anna Batista has been backed by some local politicians and the current member who sits in District 2, Linda Wren. So she's currently board president.
Only one incumbent running for reelection? What about the other 3?
Yeah, so the 3 that are not seeking you know, they're not
renomination.
Yeah. All three were endorsed by the Pittsburgh Federation of Teachers, the union. And Regina Hawley is a longtime educator. She was the former board president. She was first elected in 2011. The other two board members, Maura Kaleida and Linda Wren, were both elected in 2015. So only one term for the both of them. They haven't really talked about why they're not running again. It's a lot of work. It's unpaid. It's a lot. It's a big time commitment.
Okay. So you mentioned the one district is unopposed, District 8, mm-hmm. and the other district, I think you said 4.
District 4, sure.
Right. Are there issues that cut across the entire Pittsburgh Public School District, not the individually numbered districts?
Yeah. So the budget is a big issue that all of the candidates have spoken about. You know, the district has a $650 million budget. That's about $70 million more than the city of Pittsburgh. So that's where a lot of taxpayer money is going. And the district right now is depleting its reserve fund. So it's something they're going to have to think about in the next few months. And so this board will be sworn in November, and they have to approve the budget in December. So that's something that they've talked about a lot. We're also continue to lose enrollment. The achievement gap is something that board members have spoken about. Not a lot of solutions right now. They all agree on identifying these issues that are facing our children, but we haven't heard a lot of solutions yet. They all say that we're going to get in and learn from the community what needs to happen.
What about Districts 2 and 6? Who's running there?
District 2 has 4 candidates. Mm. So I will give you a rundown here. We have David Atkinson. He works at the University of Pittsburgh. He's a parent of 3. Nosakari Griffin L. has a PhD in education. He focuses on policymaking. He's a parent of 2. Kirk Rise is also a Pittsburgh public parent. He is an attorney at BNY Mellon. And Devin Talaferro is a program assistant with Big Brothers Big Sisters. She runs a mentorship program at Brashear High School. So these are all new faces. We haven't heard from them in the past. They haven't run for none of them have run for public office before. And so it's been a learning process for them. They're all very passionate about this, and they all identify similar issues. And then we've got District 6, that's in the South Hills. Oh, I should have said District 2 is like East End neighborhoods, Highland Park, Brooklyn, or Bloomfield, and Lawrenceville. District 6 is in the South Hills, got Mount Washington, Brookline. We have Heather Fulton. She has twin daughters in Alderdice High School. And then Bill Gallagher was a former coach. He taught in Pittsburgh Public Schools for 27 years.
Okay, very briefly, a couple of these districts, there could be a sort of a candidates facing each other because of cross-filing, right?
Sure, yeah. In District 2 and District 4, candidates have cross-filed, so they could face off again in November.
Which is one of the few areas where you can run as both the Democrat and Republican.
Sure, also judges.
Okay. So to both of you, to Ariel and Sarah, what will you be following up on depending on the results of today's primary contest?
For me, just if depending on who wins, particularly it's looking like the Councillor Burgess might win in District 9. So just kind of looking at how is he going to address some of these issues that people have brought up, the issues of concerns of gentrification, the housing affordability. For District 1, just kind of seeing where is Councillor Harris going from now? Where is she going to? What are some of the legislation and some of the things she would pass? And, you know, if there is an upset, we'll definitely be talking about that.
And very briefly, Sarah, how are you going to follow up?
2 biggest jobs of the school board is to hold the superintendent accountable and to manage the budget. So those are 2 things that I will be questioning board members on.
Sarah Schneider is WESA's education reporter. Ariel Worthy is a reporter with WESA's politics and government team. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And a reminder, in other races, District Attorney Steven Zapala, who's held the office for 20 years, is being challenged by defense attorney and former chief deputy public defender Teron Jenkins. County Council District 13, Denise Russell, seeking a second 4-year term, is challenged by community organizer Olivia Bennett. And the council at large, John DeFazio, the last original member of County Council, is being challenged by Bethany Hallam. Details, WESA.FM.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. How big is your digital footprint? A new exhibit at the Carnegie Library takes a look at personal data, online security, and terms of service agreements. What do we sacrifice for convenience in our digital world? And San Francisco banned police from using facial recognition software. So how is the technology used here? To get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence, check out our website at wesa.fm/confluence.
ZZ Top had plenty of success in the 1970s. In the early 1980s, though, the band were presented with a new challenge, appealing to audiences half their age on MTV. The younger audiences wouldn't be satisfied with a standard live performance style video, so for Gimme All Your Lovin', Billy Gibbons busted out his secret weapon, Eliminator, his 1933 Ford Hot Rod. The car would end up in two other ZZ Top videos, and Gibbons had a second one made just to bring on tour. The video for Gimme All Your Lovin' debuted on this date in 1982. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. As the days get longer, a familiar sight has returned to the skies at dusk. Bats. Bats help farmers and the rest of us by eating about a million bugs a year per bat. But because of white nose syndrome, there are fewer bats these days. In Pennsylvania, the disease has pushed some species to the statewide endangered list. As Reed Frazier of the Allegheny Front reports, scientists are testing a new method to try to save these mammals.
On a bright spring morning, about 20 biologists, researchers, and students gather around the entrance to an abandoned railroad tunnel near Dubois in central Pennsylvania. Everyone's in white Tyvek suits and rubber boots. They're gathered around Greg Turner, a biologist with the Pennsylvania Game Commission, who's previewing the day's work.
Moving through the site till we get to about the middle, and the middle is where the little brown should be on the ceiling up at the top. And we're going to
The team is here to check on how little brown bats are doing. The species has been hit hard by white nose syndrome, a decade-old plague on America's bat population. This team is looking at whether a commonly used chemical can slow the epidemic. Wading into the tunnel in ankle-deep water, they get to higher ground about a quarter mile in. It's pitch black, aside from headlamps and flashlights, which reveal tiny brown creatures wedged into crevices and cracks on the tunnel walls.
So that's a little brown bat right there. And it has a little bit of a dark mask across the face there.
It's mid-March, and these bats are still hibernating. White nose attacks bats during hibernation. It disrupts their sleep pattern during winter, preventing them from storing up enough energy to survive. Turner shines his light onto clumps of bats, sometimes three or four of them piled into a small hole in the wall. Their heads are smaller than a mouse's.
So we always say, like, the size of an eraser on a pencil. If you have a crack that big, a bat can get in there.
White nose syndrome is caused by an invasive fungus, Pseudogymnoascus destructens, or PD. Brent Sewell is one of the lead researchers on the project. A biologist at Temple University, he says the PD fungus probably came to America from Europe or Asia around 2006.
I mean, the most likely scenario is that somehow it hitched a ride on somebody's caving gear.
European bats have a resistance to the fungus, but American bats don't. The disease has hit some species hard. Once common in Pennsylvania, the little brown bat is on the statewide endangered species list and might be on the federal list soon.
We are just seeing massive declines, whereas you might have seen tens of thousands of bats previously. You might go to the same exact site today and only see tens.
Scientists are trying lots of things to help these bats out. Some are working on a vaccine. This group is trying something else. Last summer, they treated this abandoned railroad tunnel with the antifungal agent polyethylene glycol. It's a common, non-toxic chemical found in products like toothpaste or laxatives. It doesn't kill the fungus. Instead, it tricks it into thinking there's a drought, so the fungus spreads more slowly. The idea came from a student of Barry Overton's, a biologist who studies fungi at nearby Lock Haven University. He says the treatment is just like spraying a field with insecticide.
We're not treating the bats. We're trying to lower the environmental reservoir of the pathogen.
Overton says he wants to see whether these treatments will have negative impacts on the state's native fungi. Microbial communities that live in Pennsylvania's caves have been built up over millennia. Overton says he wouldn't want to disrupt these fragile ecosystems. But tunnels like this one were only created in the last century, so they could be fair game.
There's plenty of abandoned mines and plenty of railroad tunnels in Pennsylvania that we could treat that could help get the population of bats up.
Two, three, four, five, six,
Greg Turner carries a ladder to a section of the tunnel where bats are packed into cracks and divots on the tunnel walls. He opens the ladder and climbs up, carrying a harvesting pole. It's a long, thin rod with a piece of fabric wrapped around the end of it. He nudges the bats with the fabric tip, and they grab on with their claws. He then lowers the bats onto a net held by the team below. After capturing them, the team members put the bats, still half asleep, in small paper bags to weigh and measure. At first, the bats are silent, but gradually they begin to stir, scratching at the bags with their claws. Marianne Gagnon, a PhD candidate at Temple, is helping Sewell weigh and measure the bats. Little Browns, she says, are worthy of their name.
So the ones we had this morning were all between 6 and a bit above 10 grams for the little brown bats.
That's the weight of 2 pennies. She tells me to pick up one of the paper bags to see how light they are.
I don't feel like I'm holding anything.
Oh, it's really light.
There's nothing in the bag.
After each bat is weighed and measured, their wings are swabbed for a DNA test for PD. Turner and Sewell then photograph each bat using a special UV light. Turner holds each bat wing down onto the light while Sewell snaps a picture from a camera on a tripod. If there's any white nose fungus on the wing, it will glow orange under the light. The orange is actually iron being pulled from the bat by a chemical secreted by the fungus. Some of the wings have orange splotches on them, signs of white nose, but some look okay. Brent Sewell points one out to Barry Overton.
Barry, look at this wing. Never seen that this time of year.
Never seen it like that.
Mm-hmm. And a little brown.
That's exciting.
Turner says that overall, these bats look like they're doing well.
The vast majority of them seem to have less infection, kind of a rate, I'd put it equivalent to like mid-season. So they probably did have a slight delay on getting exposed, which is what we were kind of going for.
He holds one of the last bats by its wings and lets it hang until it starts flapping its wings.
Fly. Come on. Fly.
There you go.
They need a little encouragement sometimes.
The bat takes off down the dark tunnel. If all goes well, it'll leave the cave in a few weeks, safe from white nose for another summer. Turner says he'll start to analyze his data when it comes in the next few weeks. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Have you thought about your own digital footprint? Wondered if maybe you should keep a tighter rein on your personal data? The Glassroom asks similar questions. It's a traveling exhibit hosted by the Carnegie Library of Pittsburgh, exploring personal data and privacy. Tess Wilson is an outreach librarian for the Carnegie Library of Pittsburgh's Library in Your Neighborhood Community and Schools program. Tess, welcome to The Confluence.
Hi, nice to be here.
So I want to start with, how did the Glassroom exhibit come to Pittsburgh?
So I was lucky enough to be a part of the Library Freedom Project. That's a group focused on library values like privacy, intellectual freedom, and democracy. And they feel that librarians are in an ideal position to fight for those values, mm-hmm. in libraries and communities. And they held a Library Freedom Institute last year, and I was lucky enough to be a part of that. It was a group of 13 librarians from around the country that were being trained as privacy advocates in their libraries. Mm-hmm. And I made the connection through that process with the Glassroom.
So it's not a Carnegie Library system exhibit, per se. It's not a regional exhibit. It goes well beyond that, does it not?
It does. It was actually created by a nonprofit called Tactical Tech Collective, and they are based out of Berlin. So this exhibit has been around the world, London, Berlin, of course, and across the country, too. We're very lucky to have it. And we were lucky to have it during Choose Privacy Week, which was the first week of May.
Okay. How much of this is to assure your customers at the Carnegie Library, no matter what branch they go to, who come and use the computers, that their data will not be compromised?
Well, if you think about services that we offer at the library, free access to public computers, free Wi-Fi, access to digital and print resources. We offer all of those with the promise of privacy and confidentiality. So this really is in line with a lot of the values that libraries hold dear. Mm-hmm.
So for those who haven't seen it, it opened actually at Carnegie Library of Pittsburgh, Oakland, beginning of May, and was there for the first couple of weeks. For those who haven't seen it, give us a description. What it involves.
So it is an interactive exhibit. You can go at your own pace. It's now at the East Liberty Branch, and you can walk it through it and take it at your own pace. It sort of just gives you some food for thought, so you can apply that however you'd like to in your life. It takes a look at how we interact with technology and how that might affect our digital footprint.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense of, do people have truly an idea how much data, how much information they're sharing without maybe even thinking about it?
It depends. I think we've had some interesting reactions to the exhibit so far. Some people have sort of come in with an idea, and this has just been an interesting way to dig a little deeper into those ideas and find some more resources. Some people, I think, are a little surprised, and hopefully that information can turn into action and to help people take a little bit more control over their own personal data and how it exists in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think we might not be quite aware of all of the connections that are made through the technologies of convenience that we rely on so heavily today.
Any can't-miss aspects of the exhibit that you want to make sure that people don't miss?
Yeah, there's a poster on the window. It's placed on the window in East Liberty, and it's sort of the idea of data portrayed as a selfie, and where your how your data exists in the world, and when you take a photo, what geotagging is happening there and what metadata is involved. It's a really interesting look at something that we do every day. A lot of us post photos to Instagram, post photos on Facebook, and how complicated that relationship can be.
How can I say this? Are you a bit of an eavesdropper to sort of watch people's response and the reactions who are, you know, taking in this exhibit?
It has been interesting. And I think that's sort of why we wanted to do the workshop that's happening on Wednesday as well. Mm-hmm. We wanted to start those conversations because it's always interesting to hear a variety of perspectives on this. We do risk a lot for convenience when it comes to personal data. And so to have that conversation about what conveniences we'd like to have and what we're willing to risk for that, and perhaps what we're not willing to risk for that, and taking more control over that is really interesting. So I do, one of the cool parts about workshops like the one that's happening on Wednesday is listening to the conversations and hearing challenges to that kind of philosophy, and also people who are just being armed with more information than they came in with.
So you mentioned the workshop. It's the My Terms of Service. Where? What time?
So it'll be at Carnegie Library Pittsburgh, East Liberty.
Where the exhibit is now.
Yes. And so you can pop down before and see the exhibit. And it'll be from 6 to 8 p.m. And that's a free workshop.
What can we learn from that workshop, from that class?
What I hope to do with the workshop is to examine what we're agreeing to when we check the I agree box. It's sort of ubiquitous now, and pretty much to do anything on your phone, your computer, et cetera, you need to check that box. So trying to understand what it is we're actually agreeing to and who else has access to that data once we check that box.
And you mentioned that the Glassroom is at East Liberty until when?
Until the end of the month.
Other branches getting involved?
No, just these two for now. We were lucky to have it for a whole month, though, and to have it at two locations and in two different formats. When it was at Oakland, it was upstairs in a room by itself. In East Liberty, it's sort of out in the open on the main floor. So it's been kind of interesting to see how people interact in those different situations.
But folks still have about 10 days, a week and a half to get to East Liberty to see it.
Yeah, I encourage everyone to at least pop by. As I said, it's at your own pace, so you can stop by and just take a quick look if you want to.
There's a project that's related to the Glass Room. It's Data Detox. Is that about putting down your devices or getting maybe a better, maybe even a bird's eye view on how logged on, how plugged in we really are?
I think that's a really good way of putting it. It's you can actually get to it at datadetoxkit.org, and that's a project that Tactical Tech Collective did with Mozilla, and it just is a step-by-step detox plan for you and your data, and you can sort of take what you want and not do some things, do other things. It really is just a way to get more information about how much you're using your technology, how reliant you are on it, and what data that might be using and spreading around.
All right. Detox almost sounds like a purging, but you're not necessarily saying tech is a bad thing, are you?
No, I think it's just important, as you said, to arm people with information about what we are involved with when we're so involved with tech. And it's becoming more and more a part of our lives and more interconnected. And so understanding that, and it's happening at a really rapid pace. So it's really important that we understand how we fit into that equation. And I think libraries are in a unique position to help folks out with that.
Okay. And again, how can people access Data Detox?
It's at datadetoxkit.org. And Tactical Tech Collective also has a project called Me and My Shadow, and that's at myshadow.org. And that that just focuses on digital traces and your data footprint that you leave as you travel around the web.
And briefly, Tess, you mentioned before at the beginning of our conversation that you work on the Library Freedom Project. Tell us briefly, what is the mission of that project? What is the goal?
So they are a group that focuses, as I said, on library values like freedom, like intellectual freedom, privacy. And they are fighting to help libraries be in a position to fight for those values. They train groups of librarians every year in the Library Freedom Institute, and they're essentially trying to get our data back into our hands and not necessarily into the government's hands and other parties' hands.
Okay, in our last minute, how do you hope that the exhibit, tomorrow's workshop, the data detox will help people become more aware of online privacy?
I think just digging a little bit deeper than simply checking a box and moving on, digging a little deeper than just snapping a selfie and posting it to Instagram. If people take away anything, I think it's just to think a little bit more about what those processes look like on the other side.
And I would be remiss if I didn't ask a librarian about recommendations.
Well, I would recommend Smart Cities is a really interesting look at the Internet of Things and how cities are using tech, and that's by Anthony Townsend. I'd also recommend Habeas Data. That's a little bit heavier, and it's more focused on surveillance and data, and that's by Cyrus Farivar. I'm sure I pronounced that wrong. And then Dear Data is a really fun look at personal data. It was a project by Stephanie Posavec and Georgia Lupi, who actually came to CLP last year.
Tess Wilson is an outreach librarian for the Carnegie Library of Pittsburgh's Library in Your Neighborhood, Community, and Schools program. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
And we'll have more about the library's privacy programming on our website, wesa.fm. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. There are surveillance cameras just about everywhere at red lights and banks, along business districts and more. We've grown accustomed to the cameras, but is facial recognition a step too far? Joining us now is WESA's legal analyst, University of Pittsburgh Law Professor David Harris. David, thanks for popping on by.
Kevin, always good to be with you.
All right. So remind us first, what is facial recognition technology and how could it be helpful for law enforcement?
Facial recognition technology takes an image, one from a still camera or captured in video, it constructs a digital map of a face, the distance between the eyes, the distance between the eyes and the mouth. All the different aspects that make every face unique are digitally measured and recorded. And then it compares that digital map to digital maps already in the system of millions of other faces and tries to make a match or a list of possible candidates for a match.
Okay. Last week, the San Francisco Board of Supervisors voted to ban the city's use of facial recognition software. What was the reasoning behind this decision?
The reasoning is that the folks in San Francisco who were behind this bill thought that facial recognition represented dangers to public spaces and to personal privacy. They saw facial recognition as a law enforcement tool that had great, great potential to turn any public space into a surveilled state, and that that was a step too far for them, as you said, toward a police state, toward a set of circumstances in which any person going outside would effectively be subject to being cataloged, searched, tracked, and all kinds of other things. And they just did not like those prospects, knowing even that there was a possibility, a not remote possibility, that this could be a good law enforcement tool. They opted instead to ban it altogether because of what they perceived as the privacy dangers.
Okay. So was it how it was being used by San Francisco police or how they actually planned to use it?
Well, actually, neither one. It's funny. San Francisco's police had tried facial recognition in one form or another in the past, but had actually opted to drop the tool as of right now. So they're not using it at all.
Oh.
What you have to remember, San Francisco is kind of the tech hub of the world. It's Silicon Valley. It's all those tech geeks living there. And so they saw this not just in terms of its current use, not that at all, but in terms of its potential for abuse going forward.
All right. So we've seen facial recognition portrayed on television, crime shows such as NCIS.
Sure.
See faces rushing by, blurring by on a computer screen, looking for a match. It doesn't really work like that, of course. So what are its downsides, potential dangers?
Well, the potential dangers involve its accuracy and the biases baked into it and the dangers to privacy. Let's take those one at a time. In fact, facial recognition is in many under many examinations we've seen in the last couple of years not really fully ready for prime time, certainly not in the way that we'd think of seeing it on TV. It is not accurate in a substantial number of cases, and it is particularly inaccurate when it is tracking or looking for faces of people of color and women. People of color have darker skin and darker features, of course, and women use makeup. You put the two together, you've really got problems. And you find actual gender mistakes with women of color. They can't tell the difference between a man and a woman. So it is not as accurate as people think. The privacy issues we've actually already gone through and talked about. And one of the other dangers is that because of its inaccuracy with regard to people of color, it tends to bake in certain biases that already exist in the system. We have many more shots of people who have been arrested, for instance, of people of color. And one might argue that many of those is because of the outsized attention that people of color get from police. And if that's the case, you're going to be searching those. You're going to have greater numbers of false hits with those. And so all of that together, those represent some substantial downsides along with building a kind of technology for mass surveillance. And I think that's what people object to.
So San Francisco is banned. Is this something other cities are considering?
There are similar ordinances being considered in other cities and even at some state levels because a city council can do it. A state legislature can do it. What is becoming, I think, the focus of public discussion is, okay, maybe you don't ban it, but maybe we should regulate how it's used because it doesn't have to be an all or nothing proposition. And so there are a lot of considerations for regulation on how this technology can be used for certain circumstances, in certain ways, maybe with a warrant, whatever it is, rather than banning it outright.
David, facial recognition is being used in Pennsylvania by state police and PennDOT. For what purposes?
Well, PennDOT uses it to make sure that when it grants somebody a driver's license, it is not being toyed with in fraud. In other words, it will take the picture and the identity details given by the person and compare it to all other photos in the database of PennDOT to see if there is a very similar or identical looking person in the mix in the existing photos. And if you're trying to use somebody else's identity, that wouldn't be acceptable. So it's giving out interim driver's licenses in such situations where there's a possibility of fraud and then checking that further. The Pennsylvania State Police are among the agencies in the state that are making some uses of this. There is a fairly large database of images and photos that the Pennsylvania Chiefs of Police Association, a nonprofit private group, has put together, and many, many police agencies in the Commonwealth are able to use it, among them the Pennsylvania State Police.
Are there transparency issues here, though?
Oh, yes, because the Pennsylvania Chiefs of Police Association is a private group. The Right to Know law does not apply to that group. So that makes it a little more disturbing. I mean, if we, you know, if transparency is the mother of good government, we want to be able to know who's using this and how they're using it and what's happening with it. And if it is not transparent, that puts it beyond our oversight as we the people.
So as we have a couple minutes left. So as a practice, does facial recognition violate the Fourth Amendment's reasonable expectation of privacy against government intrusion?
Not necessarily. The way the reasonable expectation of privacy rubric has been kind of set out by the Supreme Court under the Fourth Amendment, when you're out in public, you don't have necessarily have a reasonable expectation of privacy. And so things like your voice and the look of your face do not have those kinds of guarantees against unreasonable searches and seizures when you're out in public. This actually goes beyond what the Constitution protects, though, this set of questions. We might say, okay, you don't have an expectation of privacy out when you're out in public and showing your face, but does that mean that the government should be able to know who you are and track everywhere you go using facial recognition and all the cameras mounted everywhere? So we don't have to only talk about the Fourth Amendment and reasonable expectation of privacy. We should talk about what this technology means to the state of our government, to protesting, to all those things we hold dear.
Okay, briefly, David, it's so often it seems like our laws are behind tech. Could this be an example of laws jumping in front of technology?
It is. And it's so interesting to me because I've been advocating for a long time, along with many others, that we should not simply wait for courts to rule on these questions and only rely on the Fourth Amendment and the Constitution. What we should do instead is ask ourselves as a society, as a city, as a state, what kind of society, city, or state do we want to have? What kind of public interaction do we want to have? We can make laws and rules for our policing and police departments that go forward and jump ahead of tech. We don't have to wait until the police start using them and then challenge them, and only then in criminal cases. That's how the Constitution works. We should be talking about them now before they're widely deployed and decide what kind of society we want.
In a sentence or so, is there a middle ground, regulating it, not banning it?
Absolutely, because there are reasonable and good uses for facial recognition. We've seen that in actual concrete cases. We shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater, to use the old saying, but we should regulate it and ask, when do we want it used and under what rules?
David Harris is a University of Pittsburgh law professor. He's WESA's legal analyst and the host of the podcast Criminal Injustice. Thanks so much, David.
Kevin, always a pleasure.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, hospital protocol can differ depending on the disease or virus, whether it's influenza, measles, or even Ebola. We'll talk with Dr. Graham Snyder about how to prevent transmission of pathogens. Plus, a conversation with Mayor Bill Peduto. Why is he delaying enforcement of the city's new gun control ordinances? If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Julia Zenkovic and Julia Maruka. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.